IELTS Listening Test. Sample Test 5. This test is published and recorded by 9.09er English. This recording is copyright. You will have to respond to questions based on the recordings you will hear. You will be given the chance to read the directions and questions, and you will be given time to check your answers. You are allowed to listen to each section once only. Four sections make up the test. You will have 10 minutes to transfer your answers to an answer sheet after the test. Now, listen to the first section. IELTS Listening Test 5. Difficult. Section 1. Part 1. You will hear a conversation between a police officer and a man reporting a crime. First, you will have some time to look at questions 1 to 10. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 10.
Good morning. Welcome to the Liverpool Police Department. How may I help you?
Hello. I would like to report a home burglary.
Okay, just a minute while I pull up the form. Before we address your report, I need to get your personal information. Will that be okay?
Sure.
All right. Could you state your full name, please?
Paula Wiseman.
Wiseman? W-I-S-E-M-A-N?
No, it's Wiseman. W-E-I-S-S-M-A-N.
Got it. Thank you. Gender, female. How about your date of birth?
25th of August, 1991.
Okay, what's your address?
Apartment 1B, Adelaide Road, Kensington. That's A-D-E-L... AIDE Road, Kensington.
Is that the same address as the burglary you want to report?
Yes, it is.
What's your postal code?
L78SH.
Right. We've had a number of reports of theft and break-ins in that area these past few weeks. Are you a citizen of the UK?
No, I'm only here for university. I lived in Canada for a while before moving to the UK.
Okay, let's address the issue at hand. You would like to report a burglary, right?
Yes.
And have you had any previous break-ins?
In the building or just my apartment? Two of my neighbours had similar break-ins. One last month and the other 3 months before that.
Adjust your apartment, please.
Well, in that case, no. This is the first incident I have of someone breaking into my home.
Right. And how long have you been living in your apartment?
About 6 months, I guess. I moved in on October 21st and it's already May, so that makes it 7 months.
Are you currently living alone or do you have a roommate?
My boyfriend lives with me, but he's visiting relatives who live out of town right now, so he hasn't been home for a week already.
Okay, and have you noticed anything unusual lately? Anyone suspicious in your neighbourhood?
No, not really.
How about any strangers or parked cars around recently?
I can't say for sure. Oh, I do recall one of the tenants asking me if I knew who kept slowly driving by our apartment building at night with their lights off. They had been driving aimlessly around our area over the past few weeks.
Can you give me a description of the car?
From what I can remember, it was a black car. I think it was a 1978 Dodge Omni, but I'm not too sure. What I can say, though, is that it had a large dent on the left rear door and a Sheffield United decal on the right rear window.
Okay, we'll look into it. Now, can you tell me how you discovered the burglary?
Sure. I spent the night at a friend's house, and when I got home around 10 minutes ago, I immediately knew something was wrong. My apartment was a mess. It was ransacked and some items were missing.
Can you recall what time you left yesterday?
Yes, I left around 7 p.m. yesterday and came home at 10:35 a.m. today.
Did you notice any signs of forced entry?
Yes, my living room window was open, and it looked as if someone had used a crowbar to pry it open. It couldn't have been open because I always make sure to lock all windows before leaving my apartment.
I see. Now, can you tell me about the missing items from your apartment?
Of course. So far, the most valuable items I'm missing are my Fender bass guitar and wireless speakers.
Okay. What is the estimated value of your bass guitar?
£913, to be exact. I remember it because I just purchased it last weekend.
Do you know the serial number as well?
Yes, 187304.
And what does it look like?
It's a 34-inch vintage-style light blue bass guitar with a white pickguard and a rock and roll sticker on the body.
And what about the speakers?
Unfortunately, I can't recall its serial number, but it's a Marshall Stanmore Bluetooth speaker in black. It's about 14 inches wide. I think I got it for around £300.
Okay, that's all. We'll let you know as soon as possible if there are any updates on your report.
That is the end of Section 2. You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Section 2, Part 2. You will hear a manager orienting a new employee to the workplace. First, you will have some time to look at questions 11 to 17. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 17.
Hi, it's so nice to meet you. I'm Jenna. I'm the manager and owner of Ground Up Cafe. I'd like to formally welcome you to our team. But before I introduce you to the rest of the staff, I'd like to go through the employment basics and workplace policies with you. All right. For your schedule, we expect you to work 6 days a week, Mondays to Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. You'll be pleased to know that we don't operate on Sundays, so as to give our employees a day off from the working environment. It can get quite hectic here, especially during peak hours, so it's important for us to ensure that we don't overwork our staff. We're also closed on certain holidays such as New Year's Day, Christmas, Easter Monday, and Good Friday. What else? Early May bank holiday and spring bank holiday as well. Now let's talk about your pay. You'll get paid £928 per hour. That would be £74.24 a day and roughly £1,781 a month. This will be directly deposited into your bank account twice a month, every 15th and 30th. However, in the instant that those days fall on a weekend or a holiday, your salary will be deposited on the day closest to the 15th or 30th. Is that clear? Okay, now let's move on to some of our policies. It is the primary responsibility of our employees to arrive on or before their scheduled shift. If, however, an unexpected situation arises that might cause you to be late for work, please inform me immediately through a text or a phone call. The same rules apply if you're unable to show up for work due to an illness or an urgent matter. If that does happen, please do try to inform me at least a day before or hours ahead of your shift so I can call in a replacement. But if you fail to show up without any notice, this may lead to a disciplinary action. And if this becomes a habit, you will eventually be terminated. We only allow 2 unexcused absences. If a third one follows, you will have to be dismissed from your position here in the cafe. As for our uniform, we currently do not have a standard dress code, but we will provide you with an apron that you must use while you're on your shift. We also encourage you to wear something comfortable, but still neat and professional, as your appearance reflects the image of Ground Up Cafe. You are permitted to wear certain jewelry as long as it does not interfere with the functions and safety of your job. We also require that you pull back your hair in a ponytail or bun if the length is past your jawline. Wearing hats is also acceptable. However, we reserve the right to prevent you from wearing certain hats that have unprofessional or vulgar logos or texts. Furthermore, grooming your hair while on the floor or back of the counter is strictly forbidden, as this may violate sanitary rules. Finally, we don't encourage you to use heavily scented perfumes, lotions, or aftershaves because this might irritate customers and co-workers that might be sensitive or allergic to these. At any time during your shift, you are welcome to prepare drinks and 1 food item for yourself. In fact, we encourage our employees to sample the items on our menu so they can recommend our best drinks and food items to our customers. Nevertheless, this does not mean that you can provide food and beverages to friends and family free of charge while on your shift. If caught, the total amount of items served will be deducted from your salary. We also discourage texting and making calls during your shift, except in the case of an emergency. However, there is no excuse to be using your phone in front of customers, so please go to the back if you absolutely need to make a call or text. All right, that's about it for our policies. Since you're new here, you'll have to undergo a training program with our senior staff to help you learn the ropes in no time. Let me introduce you to Mike. He's our barista on duty today.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you will have some time to look at questions 18 to 20. Now, listen and answer questions 18 to 20.
Hey, I'm Mike. It's nice to meet you. I'm going to teach you some basic coffee-making skills. Let's see. Let's start with espresso. But before I can teach you how to make it, you need to learn about the parts of our espresso machine and its purposes. Here in our cafe, we use a standard espresso machine. First, you need to know about the portafilter or group handle, which contains a coffee basket. Once ground coffee goes into the basket, the group handle is then inserted into the group head, which is the part found directly on its left. The group head is where the espresso is made by producing and forcing water through the coffee grind. The section beneath these two parts is where we place the coffee cup. It's referred to as the drip tray, which also captures wastewater and funnels it into the drain. Now, if you look on the right side of the portafilter, you'll see a short spout and a slim protruding pipe that sticks out. The shorter spout is a hot water tap where we can get hot water for our Americanos, teas, and any other functions requiring hot water, while the other is called a steam wand. We use this in producing foam and steaming milk when making espresso. We have what we call the bean hopper on the topmost left part of the machine. It's generally a large and clean container on top of the grinder. It can either be made out of plastic or glass, but here we use the glass type. It essentially just holds the espresso beans until they're fed into the grinder. Below the bean hopper are three circular buttons. The first one is the power button to turn on the espresso machine, while the second is the grind dial that allows us to adjust the amount of freshly ground coffee dosed into the filter basket to suit the fineness or coarseness of the grind.
That is the end of section two. You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Section 3. Part 3. You will hear two architecture students called Emily and Harry discussing a lecture they are going to do together. First, you will have some time to look at questions 21 to 24. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 24.
Harry, we better decide on a topic for a class presentation that's due at the end of the month. Mr. Goldman is probably expecting a lot from us since Sarah and Michael's lecture on transnational Asian architecture history did so well this week.
You're right. Actually, I've been thinking about possible topics that we could choose from. How do you feel about doing a presentation on ancient Greek architecture? I've considered Victorian architecture as well, if you're up for it.
That sounds interesting. But I've heard Tom and Liz have already decided on presenting the architectural styles of ancient Greece. I think it would be better if we choose Victorian architecture instead. In fact, I've researched quite a lot about it in the past because I've always been fascinated by some of the architectural choices made during that time period.
Great. Your prior research will certainly work in our favour. Any suggestions on what we should include in our presentation?
Let's see. Well, we should definitely include a brief history of this architectural style.
Right. From my limited knowledge of it, I know that this emerged in the United Kingdom during the reign of Queen Victoria. However, I don't know much about why this became so popular in that time period.
Well, to make it simple, many adored Victorian architecture and design because it reflected the lavish sensibilities of the era and appealed to the idea that houses and other buildings were meant to be beautiful as opposed to practical.
Oh, I see. But is it similar to other styles, like neoclassical architecture?
Actually, it's quite different. Neoclassical architecture is inspired by a more classical style found in ancient Greece and Rome. It bears formal proportions and exhibits a classical and ageless beauty. In the past, homes that were built using this style were thought to be a reflection of where house owners were in the class system. On the other hand, Victorian architecture is influenced by various well-known techniques, including Gothic Revival, Second Empire, Romanesque, and many others. It was designed to show off wealth and excess.
Is that so? I assume they would be quite similar. Are there any distinct physical differences between the two? If there are, I think we should include that in our presentation to give a clear comparison of the two.
Yes, there are. Unlike the uncluttered and minimalist appearance of the neoclassical style, one key element of Victorian architecture is its decorative trim and textured wall surfaces. It is not uncommon for many Victorian homes to be decorated with ornately carved wood panelling or metal trim. They would even be painted in vibrant colours and have scalloped shingles and patterned masonry.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you will have some time to look at questions 25 to 30.
Now, listen and answer questions 25 to 30.
Oh, I get it. Neoclassical is a more simplistic form of architecture, while the Victorian style leans towards an ostentatious design.
Exactly. Another noticeable difference between the two is that neoclassical buildings commonly have flat and horizontal roofs, often containing a dome in the center. The reason for this is its inspiration from ancient Greek architecture, wherein symmetry, harmony, and balance are important characteristics. Meanwhile, Victorian buildings have a more complicated asymmetrical shape with their steeply pitched roofs and large wraparound porches.
If I'm not mistaken, Victorian architectural buildings also have gardens laid out in a certain pattern, right?
No, actually, it's the other way around. Neoclassical buildings, especially those built in the 1800s, are usually surrounded by gardens that are laid out in geometric patterns. It's also worth noting that despite the simple design, neoclassical buildings are massive, with a row of tall columns resembling Greek and Roman temples.
Oh, my bad. I guess I remembered it wrong. Well, let's go back to our main topic.
Do you think we should also include some information about the interiors of Victorian homes?
We could do that. Are you familiar with Victorian interior design?
As a matter of fact, I had a professor that discussed it a bit last semester.
That's convenient. What can you remember from what he taught?
Well, according to him, darker colours were used for the interiors of these houses because these colours would hide the effects of smoke and ash resulting from coal fires that were lit to warm the inside of the house.
Oh, I didn't know that. What else could be found on the inside of these houses?
Excessive ornamentation is another characteristic of Victorian homes. Every surface would be covered with decorative items. Windows would have long and beautiful drapes, couches would be covered in embroidered cushions, and the wooden floors would be covered with woven rugs to add to the visual appeal of the house.
That's perfect. I think we've covered the outline of our presentation. We just need to research a little bit more for additional information. I'm sure we'll do pretty well since we've chosen a great topic.
That is the end of section 3. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Section 4, Part 4. You will hear a teacher give a lecture on the history of electricity. First, you will have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40. So, what I'm going to talk to you about today is the long history of electricity. Because it's something that has become an absolute necessity in our day-to-day lives, I think that it's important that you all know where and how it all started. Right, well, electricity, contrary to belief of others, was not invented by humans. It's actually a natural force that has been around for an eternity. There have been many speculations as to who truly discovered electricity. Some believe that it was Benjamin Franklin who learned of it through his experiments. However, scientists have uncovered evidence that the notion of electrical charge
may have been known to humans as early as 2,600 years ago. Pre-Socratic Greek philosopher Thales of Miletus originally discovered static electricity by rubbing animal fur on substances such as amber. He observed that the charged amber buttons could attract light objects such as hair. He attributed amber to having a soul of some sort, not knowing that what he discovered was the first observations of static electricity and magnetism. Ancient texts from Egypt depict the use of the electric Nilefish, which had the ability to set off shocks in the body. It is presumed that they may have used the species for medical purposes, particularly in the treatment of headaches and nerve pain. This continued to be practiced until the 1600s. Careful examinations of Egyptian history also revealed the absence of soot in the corridors of the pyramids and the tombs of the pharaohs, raising the question of whether they were able to light these areas with the use of electricity. Later on, evidence emerged that the Pharos Lighthouse of Alexandria was powered by arc lamps and battery jars, further proof that electricity might have been used in ancient Egypt. In an expedition led by Dr. William Koenig in 1936, he came across a vase made of clay, approximately 14 centimeters high, with a diameter of 8 centimeters. This came to be known as the Baghdad Battery. Studies on the artifact suggested that it was probably 2,000 years old upon its discovery. The Baghdad Battery is one of the most discussed examples of advanced technology used in ancient times, not only by Egyptians, but by the Greeks and Romans as well. Inside the vase is a hollow cylinder made out of a sheet of copper. The bottom end of the cylinder is also covered with a copper sheet just below a 3 millimeter layer of asphalt. The upper end, however, was sealed with an even thicker layer of asphalt, and in the center of it was a solid iron rod. However, further studies on this instrument led scientists to the conclusion that it could only generate a weak electric current. In 1600, English scientist and the founder of the study of magnetism, William Gilbert, recognized the connection between magnetism and electricity. He then created the first electroscope in the world to detect electric charges. The term electricity is derived from the Latin word he coined called electricitas. Then, in 1752, as many of you have been taught, Benjamin Franklin discovered electricity with his famous kite-flying experiments done in the midst of a thunderstorm. His experiment included a kite with a key tied to the end of a string, which was connected to a Leyden jar. When lightning struck the kite, the electric current traveled down the string through the key and into the Leyden jar. His experiment was widely successful, as he was able to demonstrate that lightning was a form of static electricity. After the results of Franklin's experiment spread throughout the world, many scientists followed his quest to understand the concept of electricity. Almost 50 years after Franklin's discovery, Italian scientist Alessandro Volta experimented by soaking paper in salt water with zinc and copper positioned on opposite sides of the paper. This created a chemical reaction that produced an electric current, which became the first electric cell. Volta connected many of these cells together to create a battery. Years later, another scientist, Michael Faraday, became the first to learn of the possibility of producing electric currents by passing a magnet through a copper wire. This discovery is actually quite significant because almost all the electricity we use today is produced with magnets and coils of copper wire in power plants. Additionally, both the electric generator and electric motor were built based on this principle. From 1878 to 1880, Thomas Edison, one of the most well-known inventors of all time, worked on countless theories to create an efficient incandescent lamp that produces light through the use of electricity by heating a thin strip of material called a filament until it gets hot enough to light up. Unlike others who attempted to invent this, Edison's lamp would include a filament housed in a glass vacuum bulb. He wanted to come up with a high-resistance system that would not require as much electrical power as that used for the arc lamps. Eventually, he was able to build his first high-resistant incandescent electric lamp. However, he found that it would only light up for a few hours. Hoping to improve his invention, he tried to use a carbonized cotton thread filament. He determined that when voltage was applied to the bulb, it would emit light that would last for about 15 hours before burning out. This discovery led to further experimentation on filaments that could prolong the light bulb's longevity.
That is the end of the listening test. You now have 10 minutes to transfer your answers to the listening test answer sheet.